Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday, the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which six amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Before we begin today's episode, I'd like to tell you a few exciting things that we've got coming up. All of our Ko-fi supporters will have access to additional exclusive content. Each week, they'll see the written critique provided by Carly, Cece, or myself to one of the writers whose work will appear on the podcast. And those who support us on Ko-fi on a monthly basis will get access to even more additional critiques from that week's episode. Now, the written critiques offer additional information that isn't discussed on the podcast. It's additional observations, perhaps line edits, etc., that every writer can learn from. Now, if you want to support us on Ko-fi, head to the podcast page on my website, biancamaray.com, and there's a sign up button there. And then as well, we're running a fundraiser for Coletto Mapai, a South African author who's been a guest on the podcast. Coletto is an enormously talented writer who's been accepted to prestigious grad schools across the world to do her master's in creative writing. Now, writers of color face huge barriers to entry in publishing, which is why we need more own voices stories. We're raising funds to help empower Coletto to pursue her dreams and to help reduce some of those barriers to entry. Now, for every $20 that you donate to this amazing cause, you get one ticket into the draw to have a full manuscript evaluation done by me. Once we reach the halfway mark in our fundraising efforts, I will do the first draw for a full manuscript evaluation. And once we reach our final goal, I will do a second draw for another full manuscript evaluation. So if you would like to support Coletto, again, go to the podcast page on the website, biancamaray.com, and you can make your donation there. And then finally, don't forget about our upcoming The Shit No One Tells You About Writing virtual retreat in January. We have an amazing stunning lineup of world-renowned writing experts, including Lisa Cron from Story Genius, Jessica Brody, Save the Cat, writes a novel, Courtney Mom from Before and After the Book Deal, Valerie Francis, who's an accredited editor in the Story Grid Method. We also have Sally Kim, who's one of the most amazing editors in the world, who'll be chatting with all of us. And we have Britt Bennett, who is the number one New York Times bestselling author of The Vanishing Half. This is not a lineup you want to miss. The retreat will have 16 hours of jam-packed content, which is the equivalent of signing up for an 8-week writing course where each class is 2 hours per week. But even if you signed up for a class like that, you'd have one instructor as opposed to industry experts whose brains you'll be able to pick after their presentations. And then besides the fabulous guests, we'll be offering writing software discounts to our delegates, as well as the chance to win amazing prizes. And then we've set up the Shit No One Tells You About Writing book club, which Cece will be running 4 times a year, in which we'll not just be reading a book together, but unpacking it as writers in terms of elements of craft. And those who sign up as delegates will automatically get access to that book club. So if you're interested in that, go to the website. It's under the courses and retreats page and sign up for that. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another Books with Hook segment. Today, we've got two authors on who have submitted their work to the new Books with Hooks format via the website, whereby as a writer, you need to pick which agent you would like to submit to, either Carly, Cece, or a guest agent who specializes in your particular genre. And today, we're starting off with Melissa Chen, who submitted her query specifically for Carly, and she was chosen to come onto the show to discuss the query with Carly. So, Melissa, welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have you on. Could you read us your query letter?
Thank you. I will. Dear Bianca, Cece, and Carly, Bianca, thank you for your podcast. I binge listen when I'm not playing referee to my 3 boys and while doing chores. Carly and Cece, when Cece was at a different agency, you both requested pages over a year ago for a manuscript I queried too early. Cece, we met at a virtual conference where I pitched to you and thought I had something, but in the end, I came to realize that the work was not right. Since facing those rejections, I applied to a mentorship program within WFWA and was afforded the opportunity to work with an agented author and editor. This new manuscript I have is something new with the same heartbeat I long to convey but missed in my first. This round, I hope I'm getting closer to getting it right. I believe this new submission fits Carly's list best, as I know from following her Twitter that she has been interested in marketing line management story angles and the women who follow them. Momfluencer Ashley Berg is not used to rejection, not on social media anyway. So when her new neighbor, Stephanie, attends a Facebook sales party yet buys nothing, Ashley stalks Stephanie's profile to make sure she hasn't stolen Ashley's hard-won following. But Stephanie, whose interracial family faces problems of its own in this conservative neighborhood, desperately wants a real friend, not invisibility hair care products, and sinks into social media addiction by staging family posts to earn a like from the head of the mom pack, Ashley Berg. But all is not as it seems. When Ashley and Stephanie's entwining problems come to a head, Ashley's hidden alcoholism is endangering both her and her family, and racist attacks against Stephanie's family from within invisibility hair care turn violent. Will the woman find the courage to delete their social accounts and enjoy the benefits of real life friendship? Partially born of my experience with social media and as the mom in a biracial family, Liked is a work of commercial women's fiction with dual POV, complete at 80,000 words, satisfying as a standalone yet with series potential. This is the social dilemma meets Everybody Loves Raymond with a Chinese European American family, and for fans of Siri Who Am I and Good Apple. I am a member of WFWA and have a short story published in Adelaide Literary Magazine. Thank you for your consideration.
Awesome, Melissa. Thank you so much. Right, Carly, why don't you let Melissa know what you thought of that query letter?
Melissa, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I know it's so nerve-wracking and you're just so generous putting your work out there and putting it on the podcast for hundreds, you know, if not thousands, you know, how popular is our podcast these days? I don't know, to listen to and learn from. So we're so thankful that you're putting yourself forth here. So overall, first I'm going to talk about the concept and then I'll kind of like break down the query letter itself. So I really like this concept. It feels very modern. A lot of women are going through this with like friends with the MLMs and all of that stuff and our relationship to social media and community. And so I, you know, especially moms feeling really isolated, and MLMs and Facebook and social media is a way to kind of pull people together, especially during this vulnerable time, whether it's maternity leave or being a stay-at-home mom. So I feel like this does really tap into that. And so I've been really interested to find a project in this space, because I think, as I said, there's an intersection of so many topics within just like women's issues. And obviously this is women's fiction. So I do feel like this is interesting and it has a hook here that I do think is compelling. And so I think a lot of, you know, my job is, you know, when I talk about queries on the podcast is really just how can we like tease out the hook, not bury things, and really help things rise to the top. So in terms of structure of the query itself, I know a lot of this top level stuff in terms of like, thank you for the podcast, explaining all this stuff is completely appropriate for the podcast. So I know why you put those two paragraphs in there, and for the purpose of the podcast, that's great. Obviously, you know, if you're querying widely with this, that wouldn't be something that you'd include in there, which I think, you know, but I do appreciate that you included all that great background for us. Just a shout out to Women's Fiction Writers Association. I think it's a great organization. I've worked with them since the beginning when Orly created it. So shout out to them. I think they do really, really amazing work and have such good networks there. So I think that's a great organization to be a part of. So I think that's great. And then the third paragraph, I call it multi-level marketing. I don't know if some people call it different things in different places in terms of like MLM. I would call it multi-level marketing. But again, I don't know if that's just like regionally, it's known as different things to other people, but we're talking about the same thing, the MLMs for sure. So now we're into our 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph. So a couple questions I had in this paragraph are, why the hair products? You know, you have an opportunity here to be selling anything, right? And there's so many MLMs there about like skincare and everything like that. So I wasn't sure if there was some sort of metaphor there, or like whether there was like an elevated level of like, what are we going to find out about hair care that we don't know? So I don't know if that needs to be told in the query. Invisibility hair care. I'm like, is this actually person a really good saleswoman? And she's going to tell everybody, you know, why they need like this new hair thing. Is it wigs? Like, I don't know like what it is about the hair. Again, I don't know if this is a metaphor for something else, whether this is very like self-aware. I don't know. I just had some questions about like why hair, but overall, like, yeah, I think this is really realistic. And one of the questions I had in this paragraph was, so it says, so when her new neighbor, Stephanie, attends a Facebook party yet buys nothing, I was curious about what exactly she's selling. Right. And so I get when we get to the pages, we figure out, obviously she's selling an MLM. She's not selling products, which is what we know about MLMs and / pyramid schemes and all of that sort of stuff. So that all makes sense to me in the grand scheme of things. But for sake of a query, we really need to hit that really specifically. And then the next one. So the thing about women's fiction that I know, and I love the category so much, but a lot of times what's at stake here is the stakes, right? Like I want to know with women's fiction, what happens if this doesn't work out? And with women's fiction, sometimes it's a very passive stake. It's like women can't find her true identity, or, you know, there's like a friendship breakup or a marriage breakup or a career that isn't realized, you know, and sometimes the stakes in women's fiction can be a little soft. And so I really wanted to know with this, and this is what makes women's fiction loud and very hooky, is what really is at stake if this doesn't work out. So is it, you know, I had some notes here, like obviously there's a huge things, right? Like the alcoholism and racism, you know, in this community. But in terms of like what happens and what makes it really personal, I think I just needed to know why, right? Because an easy solve to this would be like, she can just move. You know, we need to just have like not simple answers to things like that. Like, why does she need to live here? Why can't she move? Why does she need to be in this community? Why does she want friends? And what's at stake if she doesn't have friends and or her life goes bust? That sort of thing. And that's what's hard with women's fiction. So I get that. And I have a lot of empathy for writing hooky women's fiction pitches, because you're like, all the goods in the manuscript, right? You just got to get there. But the query like has to focus on those hooks. And so I want to know what's at stake and just really figure out what makes it personal. You know, is it just the fact that she's going to be a lonely mom? And in real life, that is a stake, right? But for fiction, we just need more to elevate that. But other than that, I think it's really strong. You know, I think the author bio paragraph is great. I like the title. It doesn't say a lot, obviously, like liked could mean lots of things. I think the cover image would have to do a lot of work here. So I'd be open to other titles. But yeah, I think overall it's pretty good. I would generally have all this bottom paragraph at the top. I would usually have the title and the comps and dual POV and all of that at the top. But I know there's many different ways of writing query letters, but usually I just like to know that to kind of frame my understanding of what's to come. So yeah, that's kind of it. Any questions on my query critique?
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to have gotten the chance to hear all of that from you. And I wrote everything you said down. So I think it's clear. I think that I have the specifics that I can go back and add. Thank you.
Carly, but did you want Melissa to answer any of those questions specifically for you? Or was it just a case of you wanted her to pay attention to that when she finishes drafting up their query letter?
Yeah, I think it's just, I just wanted to plant those seeds for thinking about the stakes. That's kind of the biggest thing. But yeah.
Before we move on to the actual pages, Cece, did you have any thoughts based on that? Anything you'd like to add?
I thought that was an amazing critique, as always. My very, very small note is to third sentence of the fourth paragraph, change the but for meanwhile. It makes more sense in terms of like introducing two different women. And plus you already use a but in the next paragraph. It is like the world's most minor thing, but hey.
Thank you. Thank you.
We don't like many buts and we cannot lie. Right. Okay. Melissa, would you like to tell us what's in your opening pages?
Sure. Thank you. So we begin in the point of view of Stephanie, who has just moved into this neighborhood and knows that her neighbor is a momfluencer and widely popular on Facebook, is very excited to have received a friend request from this neighbor, Ashley, and is especially excited to have been invited to this hair care party. She gets over her mom guilt about needing to leave her babies behind with her mother-in-law and goes to a store, buys the wine, comes back next door to attend the party, tries to get in, but the door is locked. She jumps down into the mulch, looks through the window to see, is everyone already there? Then sees Ashley sitting at her computer and then realizes that this is not a live in-person party, but this is a complete Facebook party that she will need to go back home alone again and attend the party via Facebook. So she does. She gets her avatar for the party based on her birthday, ends up being Betty Boop. She starts feeling very cynical about the entire party, the things that this person Ashley is doing to sell her this product seems unbelievable to her. She's starting to question what she's even attending. It's reminding her of a cult that she almost joined back in college, but she needs friends more than anything else. And so she will do whatever she needs to do to make those friends.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right, Carly, why don't you let us know what you thought of those opening pages?
So we are the timestamp queens, the name queens. So I would start off chapter one, what's the year? Who are we talking to? Because you're going to jump between POVs, right? So we need to know whose POV this is. We get it really quickly, but for the sake of organization, for the sake of anybody reading at night, you know, they're forgetting what chapter they left off on, or they want to remember whose POV they're in. It's really important for us to just know where we are. And it's just such a simple solve there. So that would be important to me. And so on page one, we have a line that says, but tonight would change everything. So I want to know, what are we changing here, right? Is it the fact that she's a single mom or something like that? And you know, this is going to change for XYZ reason. Is it because she's missing something? This is going to fill a gap for her. Like, what is it that is going to change this night for her? And I think that's just too passive of a goal, right? So I think that would be important. What I really felt like we were missing in this opening section is just a real connection with the character. I think there was a few opportunities that you missed in terms of, like, for example, she goes to her closet. You don't say her walk-in closet, her, you know, rack of clothes, her cramped drawer. Like, what kind of closet is this? And to me, that would tell me something about it. Instead of being like, Stephanie had a lot of money, or like, Stephanie's, you know, just getting by. Instead of doing that, you can use through adjectives or describing these things that are adjacent to her financial situation to tell us much more about her. So I just think you miss a lot of opportunities there just to create this visual for Stephanie and who she is. And also, she's in this neighborhood. She's next door to a momfluencer. It doesn't mean, you know, this momfluencer is a millionaire. I mean, a lot of people are, you know, objectively momfluencers and maybe not financially, right? So there's a lot of layers here. And I just don't think we're hitting on like the classism element of this in a way that I think we really could, but very subtly, right? So I'm not saying hit us over the head. I'm just saying, like, how can we be subtly explaining the classism and her position in society you know, in all of these ways, like her clothes, right? So you say she's going to put on a black sequin tank to add to her khaki shorts. So why does she choose those items? What is the, what do those clothes say about her identity? And our clothes, especially when we're going to a party, right? Like, what do we want our clothes to say about us when we're going to a party we care a lot about? I wouldn't be wearing khaki shorts to a party that I hope that people, you know, think one way of me. I don't know. Khaki shorts aren't my go-to personally, but that's okay. But what about her says like, I'm wearing my khaki shorts because I feel good in my khaki shorts, or I want to wear my khaki shorts because they're the only thing that fit me right now for any reason of weight fluctuation or children or things like that, right? So what is it about that outfit that makes her feel powerful, or she puts it on and doesn't feel powerful, right? So I just think there's lots of opportunity to weave in classism and identity through some opportunities there. So the next thing I was thinking about was the physical humor opportunities here. So I was thinking about, she's on the, I love the scene where she's just like so excited about this event. She's on the porch, like ready to like meet these moms. And then she's like, oh shit, like this is a virtual party. I am embarrassed, right? And so I love that she's just like drops down into the mulch, but I think it would have been better if Ashley went to the door and Ashley's like, I heard somebody rustling, or my Nest Cam like saw something and my Nest Cam was, you know, sent me a alert or something like that. Again, depends on like where you are in classism and society about like whether you have a Nest Cam or how you feel about surveillance society. But you know what I mean? Like there's an opportunity there for Ashley to come to the door. And she's like hiding in the bushes being like, shit, this is my first interaction with my momfluencer neighbor. So again, I don't think you have to go total like rom-com or like Bridget Jonesy like physical humor, but I just think there's some opportunities there that could be missed or that were missed that maybe you could just like hit a bit harder in terms of how memorable you want that opening scene to be, because I think you have a very memorable scene here. I want to know more about how she feels about, you know, this mom guilt and having to sneak upstairs and be on her Facebook page and things like that. I was a little bit confused about the section about the smells and how they were like, can you smell this? I don't know. I was a little bit confused about that. I'm like, obviously it's the internet, people. Like, we can't smell this. So I don't know if she is trying to be like super like MLM-y, like wellness culture, like envision you smelling this, or I don't know. I just don't know if that hit the way that I wanted it to. So those are my notes. So any questions for me?
Hold on. Before we go into that, I would like to say that this sounds like my life, because this is the exact kind of shit that happens to me all the time. And I would be wearing my khaki shorts because that'll disguise the dip or shit I'm going to drop on myself 5 minutes into the whole thing anyway. But before we go on to that, Cece, do you have anything to add on that just before we get Melissa to start asking us questions? Or if any brainstorming, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I really enjoyed this. And my note was actually similar to Carly's. I felt like the MLM angle was not sufficiently exploring all the elements that it could. I needed more subtlety, but also more information, which is hard. But again, like, I'm just echoing everything Carly said at this point.
Awesome. Okay, Melissa, what feedback do you have for Carly, and what questions do you have?
Again, thank you. I don't think that I can say thank you too many times. This opportunity is just amazing to receive all of this feedback. And again, I'm writing it down. I get what you're saying, and I agree with what you're saying, that I can bring out the class elements. I think that's a really important thing that I missed. And that's really important for the whole MLM as well, and the relationships that these women form. So I'm excited to go back and thread that in. I think I agree. I think I had the smelling over the internet thing, had it in for a while. And initially, I think I had written it a different way. And I don't think that it's working. So I think I may even just take that out entirely, the whole, because it's just too unbelievable. I kind of wanted her to come across as skeptical, Stephanie to come across as skeptical of this whole product that she's getting pitched. But I think that part might be too much.
Yeah, because I think we need to hit on why hair in this section too. Like, why this product? Like, why this product over other products? I think because if you're trying to highlight the fact that this product is absolute bullshit, and yet Ashley's trying to sell the hell out of it, like, I think you can highlight that a bit more in that push and pull. I think that's what Cece's getting at with, like, there's opportunities for subtlety, and then there's opportunities for tell us, like, how self-aware is Stephanie supposed to be, or how self-aware is Ashley to be or not to be, and how self-aware do you want the reader to be, you know, along with this journey? Are you trying to also convince us that this hair product is great, or are you trying to also bring us along for the, like, yeah, MLMs are bullshit? Yeah.
What was your thought in terms of choosing hair over something else? Tell us your intentions.
Okay. Initially, there's, without saying the name, there is a real hair care product that was an MLM that I attended in real life, a party. But the thing was that it was a real life moment, not over the internet. And I really could not smell the product. And they kept asking me to smell it in different ways, and there was zero scent, and I did not have a cold or anything. So that got me thinking, I think it doesn't work when it's just an over the computer type of a smell this product. But Invisibility, I did want the product to have the name Invisibility Hair Care, because it is a metaphor for just these things are invisible. They're being pitched as these amazing miracle products that you could be a part of selling and earning lots of money if you make it, but it's invisible. It's not, these things are not real. I mean, it can't do anything for you. I had another thought, but I forgot where I was going with that.
Yep, that's fine. So Carly, knowing that, is there something you can suggest to help her land it better? Or is there another product you think she might choose that might make it land a bit better?
I don't know. I kind of like the hair, and I just like that Ashley's going all in on hair. I don't know. It's so funny to me just because it's, I don't know. I believe you. It's real. Like, there's MLMs about absolutely everything, right? And it does hit on the beauty culture and women like being sold all the stuff that makes them feel beautiful. So yeah, I don't have a problem necessarily with the hair. I just think if there's more you're trying to say about it, just make sure that we have all the information that we need to know about the hair. It could be even like if you're trying to get on the smell stuff, like it could be even when Stephanie's on her porch, it's like, you know, she's on the porch and she's like, even her house just smells great or some, I don't know, something like that, where you, if you do want to incorporate like a smell sense, like I think there might be an opportunity there. Or when Ashley does come to the door, because I do think Ashley should come to the door, like maybe she opens the door and then Stephanie's like, oh my God, her house smells amazing or something.
Yeah.
Okay. So Melissa, we have 3 more minutes. Do you have questions specifically for Carly or Cece on things that you may be stuck with? Anything you want them to brainstorm on?
Sure. Yeah. So I remembered the one thing that I had paused on. What I would like to have is Stephanie, in terms of, you were asking about her awareness. In this opening scene, I do want her to be self-aware and aware that this sounds cultish, this sounds unbelievable. But throughout the novel, I want her to fall more and more into this cult and to really become entrenched in it, to start believing in it herself even before she gets back out again. So in this opening scene, how much more specificity do you think, like in regards to her past or in regards to how she's thinking or perceiving this product, should I go?
Well, I think you're hitting on that arc of growth, right? Of her just being like, I know this is bullshit, but I almost don't care, right? At this point, it's like, I just want a sense of community. I just want to feel connected to other human beings. And I think that's how MLMs get people, right? They're like, come on in. It's not about the product. It's about the community, right? I don't know if anybody has watched the LuLaRoe documentary, LuLaRich documentary on, I think it was Amazon, but it was so good, right? And what they're talking about is like, they're selling a culture. They're selling a feeling. They're not selling products. You know, and it's like they want you on board. And I totally get why women get drawn into this, because they want friends, right? Obviously, they want to be rich because they're promised they're going to be rich. And we know that like 0.0% of people, 0.01% of people actually get rich. But the reason they stick in it is one, they get kind of deep into it financially, which if our character does have a financial risk here that you're going to get into in terms of these classism elements, I think that's important. But the sense of community, right? And I think that you're hitting on here, and I'm getting the sense that she needs this community. She needs to feel part of something. So as long as you're like fully fleshing out that arc, the classism, the money, the community in a way that grows with, she can retain that self-awareness, but it's fine for her to go drink the Kool-Aid. I think that's totally fine, but we need that reckoning of like what happens when the shit hits the fan.
Yeah. Okay. In terms of that character arc, remember who your character is at the end of the novel needs to be different to who they are at the beginning of the novel. And so long as along the way, things are changing for her, and she's going, well, this is bullshit, but oh, now I'm part of the inner group. Now I'm part of the clique. So I don't care that it's bullshit. Now I need to get even closer to her so that we can see her trading her values against this thing she wants. So we need to see her getting this thing she desperately wants and then not caring so much that it is a cult as she gets what she wants. And that's a gradual thing that needs to happen in the action beats throughout the novel. So that change happens by the end.
Thank you.
I think you have something really interesting here. I think you've really layered in a lot of nuance. It feels very modern. So yeah, I really think you're onto something. going. So stick with it. I think you got something here, and well done.
Thank you.
We wish you much luck, Melissa. Good luck with it. Keep us updated and let us know how it goes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. So that was Melissa. And now we're moving on to our second guest, Stephanie Andreessen, who submitted her query letter to CC. Welcome, Stephanie. Will you read that query letter for us?
Dear CC, Carly, and Bianca, I was on my morning walk when I heard that you were opening up submissions again for the podcast, and immediately I jogged home to enter, which is really saying something, as I will do almost anything to avoid jogging. Listening to your smart and gentle critiques over the past few months has been immeasurably helpful to me, and I thank you for your generosity and wit. I'm happy to present my debut novel, Girls Trip, upmarket women's fiction, 80,000 words, multi-POV, for your consideration. Marrying the grief-stained irony of Netflix's Dead to Me with the relational tension of Leanne Moriarty's Truly Madly Guilty, Girls Trip examines the dark side of friendship and the lengths to which we'll go to protect the ones we love. Beth, Holly, Jamie, and Amanda have been friends for more than a decade. They know everything about each other, from the intimate details of Beth's latest online dating adventure to Holly's worries about getting her daughter into the college of her dreams. Although lately, things have been a bit strange. Holly has been distracted, and Jamie has grown increasingly distant with all of them, especially Amanda. When Beth finds out that Amanda's husband has accepted a job out of state and that a move is imminent, she suggests that the four of them resurrect their old tradition of going to Holly's lake house for a weekend girls trip. But before the sun sets on their first night away, one of the women will shatter the gossamer strands that bind the four of them together with an impossible plea for help. Four old friends, three little black envelopes, one deadly request. How far would you go to help a friend? Before settling in the Pacific Northwest, my family and I spent several years living in the Detroit metro area, where I met a group of women who became my dearest friends. We are scattered across the United States now, but we meet up once a year for our annual girls trip. I drew my inspiration for this novel from those yearly getaways and my own dark imagination. My friends have requested that I make it clear that any resemblance to actual persons living or dead is entirely coincidental, especially Holly. Thank you for your consideration, Stephanie Andreessen. Content warning, child loss, suicide, terminal illness.
Wonderful, Stephanie. Thank you so much. Okay, Cece, what did you think of that query letter?
I feel like any query letter that starts with Leanne Moriarty, like one of my favorite authors of all time, immediately grabs my attention.
Cece, just if you have listened to the podcast with Amy Einhorn, she corrected us, and it's a Leanne Moriarty. Oh. After many, many years of being Leanne's editor, Amy finally realized she was saying Leanne's name wrong. So carry on.
Lovely. I have also been saying Leanne's name wrong. So anyway, as I was saying, Leanne Moriarty, I love this. So I will say Truly Madly Guilty is not one of my favorite novels that Leanne wrote, but still really good. And I like that you're not comping Big Little Lies, because everyone just comps that and it's become too big. So I love that you gave me title, word count, genre comps. I love that each of their names start with a different letter. I know it probably seems really silly, but in an ensemble cast, so many people do like Susie and then, I don't know, Stephanie. And it just gets really confusing to have the same first letter to each name. So that's really good too. What I think needs work in this query letter, which is, by the way, a very, very strong query letter. By the time we get to the last sentence of the paragraph that starts with their names. So the sentence that starts with, but before the sun sets on their first night away, I feel like by then you've done a really, really great job with the setup. Four close friends spending one last weekend together before big life change, right? Like, and it's extra interesting because their friendship is strained and don't quite know why. So I'm engaged in that. But the language of that sentence, the sentence that I'm mentioning, is super vague. I need to know more about the escalation of tension to feel properly invested. I need to know what specific plot points I am going to experience when they get there to show that you have created specific high stakes, ever increasing conflict. And like, this is something we've covered in the podcast before. I get that you don't want to give too much away. I mean, at least that's what I assume is going on here. But I do think we need a little bit more, because if you think about it, the interesting part of the story is what happens at this lake house, right? But all we know is that before the sun sets, one of the women will shatter the gossamer strands that bind the four of them together. Beautifully written, but gotta agree with me. It is the world's vaguest sentence, right? Like what does that mean? I have no idea. So I do think we need more. And sometimes when I'm working with an author and I realize that they haven't given me enough, it's usually for one of two reasons. either the first reason I mentioned, which is they don't want to give us spoilers, but then just give us a little bit more and then stop at the climax. Or their story does not have enough stakes yet. The wonderful thing about stakes and tension is that you can always add it. There's tons of really, not easy as in they're not time consuming, but like easy as in objective ways to add tension to your story. So I think that's what we have to chat about. I'm glad you're on the show because this, if this were a query letter that I were reading without you here, I'd be like, I want to know why are you doing this to me? So that's one of my questions. And then the other question, once we get to the isolated line that we have before your author paragraph, again, like three little black envelopes, one deadly request, like this would be very intriguing. But given the lack of specificity that I mentioned, it feels like it's coming out of left field. I almost feels like you plucked the sentence out of a different query letter. Because I'm like, what? Deadly request envelopes? Like I have, like, do you know what, is this making sense? This is my question for you. So okay. So could you tell us a little bit more about the plot? Like, and stop at the climax. But when in doubt, just tell us. Because I need to know more to help you know what you should put there.
Sure. What happens is one of the women is dying. And she has set up this weekend getaway to have her friends come out. She wants them to help her kill herself.
Okay. And what about the reason for the strained friendship? Is someone sleeping with someone's husband? Has someone stolen money from someone?
The strained friendship between Jamie and Amanda is maybe too much of a spoiler.
Okay.
That something happened.
Is it connected to death, sex, or money?
Yes.
All three?
It's connected to death.
We might be getting too monothematic here. It's possible we'll need to introduce another plot point. I don't know. I'll have to read a little bit further to give you good advice. Okay, I think we pause on the query letter because I also don't want to know what's going to happen.
Just a second, Cece, I'm going to ask Carly's opinion, but something for you to think about is, do you think that she should add the part that it gets revealed that the one woman is dying and wants her friends to help her? Because is that the climax of the story or is that further along and is therefore that spoilage?
Yeah.
Sorry, can you tell us where more or less at what word count this reveal happens?
Probably like 30% of the way in.
Okay, then it's okay. Then it's typically okay for us to know. We get to know everything up till the climax. That's like a rule of thumb. Yeah, I think we might be getting too monothematic here. And I think if we add something to the story, like literally one more ingredient to the quiche will be perfection. But I also wanted to say, which I forgot, I really like the line about my friends have requested to make it clear that any resemblance is entirely coincidental. And I love that you have a dark imagination because so do I. And I think that the best people do.
Awesome. Thanks, Cece. Carly, there was something you wanted to add there.
Yeah. So I just want to talk big picture for a second. So you're pitching this as upmarket women's fiction, but there are a lot of really dark things happening here. Is there a thrill? Like, would you call this a thriller or why are you not calling it a thriller? I guess is my question, because I think for comps, like I'm thinking like Lucy Foley's The Guest List and The Hunting Party come to mind when you're thinking about, you know, a group of friends get together or, you know, Ruth Ware's first book, right? Like that whole like drop some friends in a pressure cooker situation and dark shit happens. That's more of a thriller element. So I'm just kind of wondering why you didn't position this as a thriller, or is it more soft in tone? Like, I'm just trying to get a tone check from you.
Yeah. So the tone I'm really going for is really like our friend Leon. So a lot, there's a lot going on, but it focuses a lot on sort of the inner workings of the four women's minds and less kind of on like a danger that they're all creeping around.
So they're not like an imminent danger is kind of what you're saying. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm just kind of, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like there's a lot of good comps out there of like, we drop down, you know, some friends in a contained location. I think the Dead to Me and the Leon comps are good then if that's what you're going for. I think Cece's right though. I think we need to just make sure it's a little bit clear that it's not a thriller maybe, or because about these little black envelopes and how they're dropping out of nowhere. Like when you say these little black envelopes and a deadly request, like to me, that's a thriller, right? And so I know you're trying to dance around the fact that we're not talking about like assisted suicide or anything like that. But yeah, I feel like it's coming out of nowhere and it's coming off like a thriller.
So just cut that line, do you think?
But it's really interesting. So yeah, I don't know. It's hard because when we're doing these critiques, it's like we haven't read the whole book. So, and sometimes it's hard for us to give as much feedback as we want to.
Do you think if Stephanie states, you know, what that climax is and says they all get together and it's revealed that one of the friends is dying and she needs her friend's help, do you think if she gives that climax and then moves on to the rest, it'll feel less like a it's relaxed. And then we understand more it's an assisted suicide.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it will feel more like Upmarket Women's Fiction. Yeah, I agree.
Stephanie, do you have any questions based on the feedback on the query letter before we go into the actual pages?
So what I'm hearing is go ahead and go all the way up until Holly reveals why she brought them there and then put in the four old friends, three envelopes part, right?
For now, yes. But I do have questions about the pages that might change. But I worry that it's still too monothematic. So we'll address that later. It's what Carly said without us having read the whole thing. It's too hard.
Okay, right. Stephanie, will you give our listeners an overview of what's in those opening pages?
Yeah, so the opening pages start with a woman called Lorna, and she's picked up a stranger and is driving her to the hospital. And we don't really know anything about the stranger in the car, except that something shocking happened at the beach. And Lorna saw the woman, the stranger's friend, being pulled out of the water, and she's driving her to the hospital to presumably see what's going on with the friend that they pulled out of the water.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks, Stephanie. Cece, what was your take on those opening pages?
I'm going to do something I've never done before on the podcast. I'm going to share my screen. Can you enable
I thought you were going to sing. I was getting very excited.
Singing is for Carly.
Hold on.
One day I'm going to join Carly in the singing. Stephanie, is this your opening page?
Yes.
Okay. For the listener, what is going on in this section that I am currently moving my mouse over, my cursor?
No timestamp?
Well, it's a blank space, right? So you're right that there's a no here. My question to you, Stephanie, because I think you're being sneaky. I admire sneaky people. Is this a prologue, Stephanie? Stephanie, tell us the truth. Is this a prologue?
Yes.
And isn't it true, Stephanie, that you have deleted the word prologue because we do not like prologues?
No, I never typed the word prologue.
Very good. You're getting off on a technicality. Well, Stephanie, in addition to cross-examining you, I am also going to, for the second time on this podcast, eat my words. This prologue works. You did a really good job. And also good job with the sneaky thing, because I might have been like, oh, prologue, but I didn't. And it works. And I knew it was a prologue right away. And I'm going to go back to see, look at the markup. What did I write here?
I think this is a prologue. Yeah. So Cece, why?
Okay, let's go back to stop sharing screen. And
for our listeners, why do you think the prologue works when so few of them do?
Okay. So the prologue works, and I still have notes on it, but the prologue works because, first of all, the writing is great. Stephanie, this is very good. You're a very good writer. I totally get the Leon comp. It's voicey just like her. The interiority of this character is like, you just nailed it. It's so, so good. It's not that I would have kept on reading. It's that I was upset, like very, very upset that I did not have the next pages. I want to read this. Please, please, please send this to me whenever it's ready. I hope it's ready now because I'm curious. It's working specifically in this case. Yes, because it incites curiosity, but because in addition to the great writing and everything else, Lorna, who is not one of the four people, right? So you typically, this doesn't work starting with somebody who's not one of the four people. Lorna is an outsider, and her assumptions of the stranger, that first of all we know is a stranger, and then all we know it's a girl, and then we know it's actually a woman with a wedding band. Like, this escalation from an outsider's perspective is just a very effective device to get us invested in the story. Plus, this means that I probably won't get too attached to one of the four friends right from the beginning, because if you had started with one of them, I would have gotten extra attached to the first one. Have you read Apples Never Fall? Did you notice that you did what she did? In the first chapter, you have the waitress. I'm not ruining anything for anyone, listeners. Apples Never Fall is Leon's latest book. Chapter one, it's a waitress listening into the conversation of four siblings. And what we glean from this waitress's eavesdropping, let's just be honest, that's what she's doing. She's being sneaky and curious, is that their mom is missing, that they worry their dad might be a suspect, and that they're somehow worried that this person called Savannah is connected. And so we have the dramatic question at the end of chapter one is, where is this woman? Why would the dad be a suspect? And who the heck is Savannah? So you did what she did. So bravo, bravo. This is very good. I love it. I love it. I love it. As I was reading this, so first page, I got, you know, she glanced over at the stranger beside her, and I was like, I want to get sharp visuals on this stranger. There are no sharp visuals. And then immediately after, you give me sharp visuals. So like, you just kept answering every single question I had. The voiciness was great. at one point, Lorna asks, are you local, just visiting? And I was like, I want to know her tone. And immediately you tell me her tone, right? Like you say that the voice had the strained quality that made it sound false. And she was bothered by that. So you gave me her tone. You gave me character development. So Lorna is an awesome character, but I'm also not super attached to her. And that's on purpose, I'm sure, because she's not one of the main people, right? Like just like I wasn't attached to the waitress on Apple's Neverfall. So absolutely great. The thing I think you need to work on, let's talk about, I will stop complimenting you now. One, and this is an actual question I have before I move on. Is it intentional that we don't know the stranger's gender right from the beginning? Like we wait a little bit until we find out that it's a girl and then we get corrected to a woman?
It wasn't gender. It was more age.
Okay. So then I would make it clear that it's a girl right from the beginning.
Okay.
Just because it's like, it's two adjustments and we don't need two adjustments. The age thing, totally get and keep that because it's working really well. And then the next thing that I would say is, I think Lorna should be curious about, although maybe she knows, but then we need to understand why she couldn't ride on the ambulance. Like usually they let people ride on the ambulance. It's something that caught me off guard. And then, and this is the part, I have one like suggestion, but this is like one big note. When we get to the line that reads, but now Lorna just wanted to go home and forget all about it, the screams, the deafening sound. Like, so up until here, Lorna was this curious, kind of nosy, you know, 60-year-old woman who I kind of, you know, was into in a very generic way. And I mean that in a good way because she's not a protagonist. But then this emotional shift that Lorna goes through just because she's a woman, it's not working. It's not that it's not believable, but it's not logical, right? Like it just feels, the fact that she's a woman and not a girl doesn't make this worse, right? Like if anything, if you're being super protective of children, which a lot of us tend to be, it makes it a little bit better, not better, but like less worse. And the shift, if this were a protagonist, I'd tell you, well, there's something in her life that makes this worse. So give us her interiority. But no, Lorna isn't a protagonist. So that wouldn't make sense. So I think that needs smoothing out. That shift doesn't need to be there. Lorna doesn't even need a shift. She can stay curious just till the end, just asking nosy questions. Like, why were two grown women like on the beach doing whatever they were doing? I don't know, something to that effect. Making sense so far? Because I have a suggestion at the end, but we're like doing good for time. So we're okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other thing I want to say, and I'm glad you've read Apples Never Fall, is that I still think we can add something more to this to raise the stakes even more, to raise the curiosity stakes. Curiosity stakes are very specific kind of stakes. It's the Savannah comment I made, right? Like woman is missing, suspect dad. That's interesting enough. But when you start saying Savannah, I even remember the waitress was like, a Savannah, another sibling. Like, so I guess the issue becomes, can we add anything here? And the challenge is that she's alone, because everything on these pages right now, what's working is Lorna's mind, right? Because Lorna's theories and her curiosity and her impression. The only thing the woman gives us is saying that it's her fault, which is interesting. Don't get me wrong. But I think we need something more. Is it at all possible for there to be, I don't know, some mysterious hospital bracelet in her wrist, which would indicate that there was an even bigger secret, like a previous hospital visit? And why would she be at the beach? Or a cell phone that she's carrying that has a weird message and the message catches Lorna's eye? I have no idea because I don't know enough about the story. And I also don't want to meddle. I want to read the pages before I meddle. But I do think that we need something more to up the stakes even more. What Carly says makes sense. Women's fiction, a lot of the times, what's writing in terms of women's fiction is the interiority. And that's great. I love interiority. But we need the outside to match that so that we can stay invested in the plot as well. And right now, the questions I'm asking aren't as specific as I want them. I want you to sharpen these. I want the reader to sharpen these questions. The question right now is, who is this person? Who is at the hospital? Who is this person in the car? What actually happened? And what is this my fault thing? But do you see how this isn't as specific as, where is the mother of the four children? Why is the father a suspect? And who the heck is Savannah? And why might she be connected? Do you understand the parallel I'm drawing? Okay, those are my notes. Please send this to me, by the way. I want to read this.
Will do.
Yeah. Okay, so Carly, did you have some thoughts that you wanted to give Stephanie before we hand over to Stephanie to ask questions and get feedback?
No, I thought Cece did a wonderful critique and it sounds very interesting. I hope this might be a match, Cece. Let me know how it goes.
She writes wonderful. Like Leon. It's very exciting.
Stephanie, you must definitely listen to today's podcast because it's Leon's editor who speaks about why Leon is so brilliant and different to other writers. So I think you'd enjoy that. All right. So Stephanie, what questions do you have? Cece, you initially said you were worried that there were thematically not enough themes. I think it was the death thing that you had a problem with. So is that something, Stephanie, that you can speak to? Is Can you give Cece an idea of what other themes or what else you've got in there?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, Leon Moriarty is my personal hero. So I have read Apples Never Fall Twice since it came out. So
you are even more obsessed than I am.
That's a huge, huge compliment that I even can come close to her greatness. So yes, I have worried that there's too much death in this book, but it is very different. It is more of a unresolved loss that comes between Amanda and Jamie that's long ago. And it's pretty different from what's going on with Holly, which is her dealing with a terminal diagnosis and a lot of other things going on in her life. So, and then there are other, I mean, Beth has a romantic subplot. And so there's other things going on. So hopefully that will break it up enough, but I definitely will examine that more. So yeah, sorry, I'm like blanking on coming up with questions. I have all my post-its in front of me here.
It's no problem. If you don't specifically have questions now, you can always submit them to us later. In terms of what Cece was suggesting in terms of upping those stakes initially, seeing the text message or something like that, what were you thinking about that? Have you got ways that you could potentially do that?
Right. So the whole point of the prologue is from the beginning, I want the reader to be guessing who is going to be pulled out of the water, which of the four women. The little gold band is there as like for the reader to kind of be watching who, because marital status is something that kind of comes into question, things like that. So that's kind of why I had that there. I don't know. I liked that Lorna got like chastened by herself, but I can think of a different way to do that, because I do agree that having just a reaction to the woman being a woman and not a girl, I kind of wanted to make the stranger in the car seem very vulnerable. So that's why. But I think I can definitely add stakes in that there's going to be other people at the beach who go into the ambulance with the person pulled out of the water and don't leave room for the last one. She gets left behind. So I can definitely talk about that.
That's already really good, right? Like the concept of getting left behind. There might be something there. I also wanted to clarify, it's not that I think there's too much death. It's that I think there's only death. So when I say that something's monothematic, I'm saying like we need to tease out the other themes in the other subplots so that this isn't like just a book with all death. Not because there's anything wrong with death, but because you want lots and lots of, you know, really juicy themes there to ensure that we're all like really hooked on what's going on. So I'm excited to read this.
Thank you. So Bianca, you didn't have a problem with the prologue, because I listened to a previous podcast with Deconstructing Theo or Reconstructing Theo where you didn't like that. So I thought you might tear me apart today.
Tear you apart? Me? Never. I'm like a kitten. Yeah, I agree. It worked incredibly well. You know, it's not, we keep saying on the podcast, it's not that we have a problem with prologues per se. It's that we have a problem with prologues that are used as band-aids to fix opening chapters that aren't particularly strong. And that definitely isn't the case in this instance. So well done.
I guess my really quick last question is, would a timestamp work? It's going to be August. I have no clue what year. And then it kind of goes back to May.
I think like the month timestamps work, because you don't want to be obviously talking about COVID in your novel. And if you put the year with no reference to COVID, people are like, why the hell are these women together? It's irresponsible. They shouldn't be all together during COVID. So I don't think you need the year stamp. What do you think, Cece? Or do you think you can just say present day and then 5 months before? Or do you think she needs the August and the May?
Either would work. A timestamp is never a bad thing. Like it always just adds clarity. I would, if you're going to go with August, I might make some reference to the summer, like to the, you know, we shouldn't have gone wherever is it that we went in May, and then like some, or if not, just present day works. They both work. And I'm not trying to be unhelpful. I'm just at this point so curious to know what happens that I want to read and then be like, Stephanie, this is what I think. And I do promise to give you feedback. Even if for whatever reason, this isn't for me, I promise to tell you what I thought, think about it.
Yeah. You know what? The timestamp thing is important, because people want to know, are they reading a contemporary novel? Is it happening in modern day? And when you have all the things that anchor a reader in modern day, like cell phones and some reference to whatever, then they find, then they don't necessarily need that exact timestamp. And you can work that in the book. Are you going to be going backwards and forwards between August and May, or this is August and then you go back to May? Yeah, then I don't even think you need the timestamps. Just do 2 months earlier or whatever, because you need timestamps when there's a long progression of time, or when you're hopping around around in time. Otherwise, I don't think that's even necessary.
This is really good, Stephanie. Really, really good.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. So that brings us to another episode of Books with Hooks for our listeners. We're going to be alternating. Some weeks, it's going to be us chatting about submissions without the authors on the podcast. Some weeks, like today, we're going to bring on two authors, one for Carly, one for Cece. So for those of you who are still on the fence about submitting, that's how it's going to work. And you can see it.
Before we go to today's guest, there's just a reminder that Cece has a course coming up on the 4th of November at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That's called Writing Emotion, How to Weave Emotion into Your Story. Go to Cece's Instagram page to find the link there to book for that course.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
I'm Chelsea Devantes, and I wrote a comedy gal memoir. It is titled, I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, but I'm going to anyway. And it is out on June 4th. I have partnered with the indie bookstore, The Purple Couch Bookshop, who I recently met, and I just love them so much. And I've also partnered with the podcast, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing, to give away 15 personalized copies of my memoir to listeners who enter the giveaway. And here's the thing. I always wanted to know about jobs, about writing, how people got into entertainment. And so when I wrote my memoir, I included all those details. I listened to podcasts like The Shit No One Tells You About Writing all the time when I was coming up, trying to learn, glean, get details, get the dirt, get the goss. I included all of the goss. It is my life. It has wild twists and turns. Listen, I date a magician. I find out my dad is not my dad. I go on to become Jon Stewart's head writer. There's all kinds of things in there, and I put a lot of deets in. So I'm looking forward to being a speaker at the All About Memoir webinar on the 11th of May, where I will be talking more about the book and more about how to memoir, because I read memoirs all the time. I host a podcast called Glamorous Trash, where all we do is cover memoirs, specifically female celebrity memoirs. So enter the giveaway to win a copy of my book, and I will see you at the workshop.
Today's guest grew up in Sri Lanka, completed her undergrad at Mills College in California, and lived in the UK before moving back to her sunny little island. She works as a corporate trainer, owns a chain of cookie stores, and is a proud dog mom to her two spoilt huskies. It's my pleasure to welcome Amanda Jayathissa. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Bianca. Thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting.
And everybody who listens to the podcast knows how much we love dogs. And we have a firm belief that you cannot be a creative person if you don't have animals of some kind. So please, when the episode airs, can we ask you to tweet some pictures of your huskies for us?
Oh, of course. That's my pleasure. I have probably a million photos of them on my phone. So we have a selection. No problem.
I think going forward, instead of posting pictures of the authors when we do our socials, we're going to post pictures of their dogs.
I can see that being very, very popular. I think that's a fantastic idea.
So let's talk about you, Amanda. This has been, I think, an amazing journey for you in terms of your journey to publication as a debut author. And we love, our listeners love listening to how an author became published, the whole origin story of their novel, how they got their agent, how they got to the publishing phase. So could you take us through that for us?
So after a bit of a stop and start on writing, I think I've always written in some sense. I've just never made that conscious decision where I told myself, I am going to be a writer. That never happened. So I've always written in some sense from the time I was very young, probably because I've always been an avid reader from the time I was very young. I was very bookish, you could say, as a child. And so it just seemed like a very logical next step for me. So when I was about 9 or 10, I started writing my first novel. I say that in air quotes, written in a pink pen, and starred me and my cousins going on this like adventure. It was ridiculous. But I was very
sounds amazing. Sounds amazing.
It sounds like a ripoff is what it sounds like. But hey, I was having fun with it. And then, of course, there were those like rite of passage, angsty teenage poems that I think everyone goes through or everyone dabbles with when they're younger. And then I suddenly got into this mood where I told myself if I don't write and have something published before my 30th birthday, that I would be an absolute failure in life. So this was me in my early 20s, like, you know, putting all these weird rules on myself that absolutely had no bearing on anything. But, you know, I set up this really funny like goalpost, and I had written a novel at the time without really putting much thought into it. And I thought I was living in Sri Lanka. So I thought, hey, I'll just self-publish it here and see where it goes. And luckily for me, it won a local award. So that really gave me the confidence that I needed to start taking this a little bit more seriously and try to actively pursue traditional publishing, because I knew from that experience that I didn't want to self-publish this time around. And I knew that I wanted to pursue traditional publishing. And I became very serious about it. But I was working on a book that wasn't working. It wasn't going according to plan. After a lot of sort of back and forth and trudging through it, I had a moment where I got very angry, and then I was writing in this angry voice, and then I was having a lot of fun writing in this angry voice. And I thought, hey, why don't I make my main character speak in this voice? And I gutted out that entire old story that I was working out. I took out the parts that I thought would work, like the plot twist and the big reveal. And then I incorporated this new angry voice, which, you know, grew into Paloma, the main character of My Sweet Girl. And suddenly something clicked, and I raced through this draft. I spent a lot of time editing this draft. Of course, first drafts are never very good.
And I started to think, okay, hey, maybe I can query some agents and see if I can seek out representation. And I was very lucky at the time. It happened very serendipitously, I think, because I was late. I was waiting for a meeting and the person that I was meeting was running late. And I just thought I'd go on Twitter and see what was going on. Back in the day, I would rarely ever check Twitter. And I started seeing this thing called DVPit. I was like, what is that? You know, it really sort of piqued my interest. I went and I checked it out and I was like, oh, all right, a platform where, you know, authors from diverse backgrounds can tweet a pitch about their book. And if an agent likes it, you are basically invited to query them, which is great because it forms that first sort of level of communication with an agent, because cold querying is very, very difficult, as we all know. And I was very lucky that I got a few likes on my tweets. And that is how I met my absolutely amazing, wonderful agent, Melissa Janasco. And yeah, and then she took on my story. And in the beginning itself, she said, I have some suggestions for you to improve it. And is that going to be okay? And I was like, yeah, of course, definitely, because I was really craving some sort of editorial input at that point, because I lived in Sri Lanka. We didn't have access to, you know, critique groups and things like that at the time here. And she gave me some amazing, wonderful feedback. And we went on submission after a few rounds of edits. And that's how I met my wonderful editor, Jen Monroe at Berkeley, and got the deal with them.
It's amazing. Amazing. So there's a whole bunch of things in there that I absolutely love that have struck a chord. So the one is the serendipity part about it, because, you know, mm-hmm. I often say that luck plays a huge part in this whole journey. You know, there's writers who've written amazing manuscripts, perhaps haven't had the luck of having the right people seeing it at the right time, and so they give up. So I love that, you know, someone was running late. Did you ever thank that person for running late?
Yes, I thank him. Like, as soon as I got the book deal, I called him up. And it was funny. It was a work meeting, but it was with one of my friends. And I called him up. I was like, goodness, thank goodness you are late. And he's always late. So I was like, you know what? That's fine. I normally get upset with you for being late, but you are forgiven, my friend. It's wild thinking about it now.
I'm someone who's really time urgent. And I'm like, if I make arrangements to meet people at 6 o'clock, I expect them to be there at 6 o'clock. Because otherwise, I'm like, it's very disrespectful of my time. But this is the one instance where it's like, thank goodness this chronically late person was late once again, because who knows how the path or the journey would have been if you hadn't sent that one tweet, right?
Mm-hmm. I know, it's just wild, absolutely mind blown. And it just worked out so well, because I feel my agent is just such a perfect fit for the ideas that I have and the kind of writing that I do, because she gives me such fantastic input. I can't even imagine where the path would have led if I hadn't met her or went with someone else. That would have been, it's just unthinkable for me now. So,
And a question I want to ask, because we get this a lot on the podcast, is your editor a person of color or not? Because often we get people like diverse authors who say, should I only be submitting diverse stories to editors of color? Is it possible to submit a diverse story to an editor who's not a person of color? So what was your experience in this regard in terms of your agent and in terms of your editor?
Great question. Neither my agent nor my editor are women of color. They have been amazing at championing my story and never, ever censoring me or made me feel uncomfortable in any way. If at all, they have been extremely accommodating. And that was something that I was very, very conscious about through the process, especially because my main character she's got a lot of thoughts, right? And she's got a lot of feelings. And she's quite abrasive and she uses very colorful language. And I was very worried at first that someone would try to take her on and water her down. And in fact, through the querying process with agents, I did have some conversations where, you know, those agents did want to sort of tone Paloma down a little bit. But one thing that I am just so appreciative of is that both my agent and my editor have always just understood what I was trying to go for, have been nothing but supportive of myself and my character and the voice that I wanted to give Paloma.
Yeah, that's hugely encouraging to hear, because, you know, there's been horror stories in the industry that, mm-hmm. you know, authors of color pitch a character who's a person of color, and then they get told, oh, well, this is great, but could they be white, or could it be less you know, whatever. And that is just infuriating. So it's wonderful to hear that you had such a great experience with that. Let's talk about Paloma and the kind of character she is, because that's another thing that, you know, we hear a lot from editors, is that they want characters to be likable. They need these characters to be softened and to be nice. And Paloma is just kick ass from the opening chapter. She just doesn't take shit. And there's a lot of cursing in here. And this is another thing we get told, take out the cursing, because otherwise you're going to have readers complaining about all the curse words. So let's talk about, how did you manage to make her kind of vulnerable and accessible to readers? Because if a character is not likable, then the reader has to have something about them that they can get on board with. And was it something you had to work on softening her, or is it something that came to you in those early drafts?
That's a very interesting question. Definitely there was a journey that we took that ended up with Paloma sort of being who she was at the end. But I think that, seeing obviously curse words and things like that on the page might be a shock, right? But the thing about Paloma, and the reason why I think people find her in some sense relatable, is that she approaches situations very much in the way that a lot of women have been trained to approach situations, in that she's thinking these very uncharitable, very ungracious thoughts in her mind. And, you know, all the swearing, all the cursing, everything, it all happens in her head. It's just that as readers, we are given a front row seat into what's going on in her mind, because the story is told in first person. But Paloma wouldn't dare utter any of this out loud, right? She wears this mask of perfection, and she portrays herself in the way that women, and especially women of color, are expected to portray themselves, especially when navigating white spaces. So I think in that sense, we can relate to her. There is always that idea that she is an underdog, right? She is a person who has been taken out of, you know, her comfort zone and thrust into this world where she feels like she does not belong. And all of us can relate to not feeling like we belong at some point in our lives. I mean, or at least most of us can relate to that sort of sense. So because of that, I think it does help to kind of bridge that gap between this very abrasive, very almost rude, mean-spirited, very salty kind of character. And the other thing that I thought about a lot was, if somebody is that way, if somebody is a little abrasive and a little rude and, you know, thinks of life or views life from a particular lens, there's usually a reason why they are that way. And I was very careful when I was putting Paloma's character together or crafting this voice, that I gave her enough of a reason, and I was able to give the reader enough insight into why she turned out the way she did.
Yeah. Let's talk about the structure of the novel. So, you know, something I'm always saying to listeners is, just because the story happens in a linear way, in terms of a character's born on this date and then these traumatic things happen to them in their childhood and then they're an adult, just because a story happens in a linear way doesn't mean that you need to write the story in a linear way. You can, you know, represent a story structure in a non-linear narrative, meaning you could begin on their deathbed and then go back in time and jump all over the place, or you could begin in modern day, present day, and then jump back to this part in their childhood that was so defining. And so that's something that you've done in the novel, and you've used this dual timeline, backwards and forwards in time between present day and the past. Was that something that was always the structure for the novel? How did that come about? How did you decide on that?
I did want to base it in the past and the present from the start. It did make sense to me in terms of that final reveal, to have this thing happen in the past and that be the reason why things turn out the way that they do in the present. It was definitely a fun experience for me, and it meant a lot, because it meant, by, you know, setting things in the past, that I could bring in elements of Sri Lanka, and I grew up in Sri Lanka, I still live here now. So, you know, I could bring in these elements from the childhood ghost stories that we used to say, to the conversations that I might have had with my friends and things like that. So it was very special to me to include all of that in. Although I do have to say that I had to spend a lot of time thinking about the 12-year-old Paloma's voice and how to make it as authentic as possible. And so something I actually did was I pulled out all my old journals from that age, from between ages like 10 and 12. And they're ridiculous, right? They're all like, oh, my brother was so mean to me today. Oh, you know, this friend of mine, she said this thing and it really hurt my feelings. It was so hilarious reading back on it, but it really did help me sort of jog my memory and think back to when I was 12 and the things that we would talk about and the way we would speak to each other. So that was a lot of fun for me as well. But I definitely knew that I wanted to write in a dual timeline. It did take a little bit of planning, of course, and there were Excel sheets involved to make sure that I don't, you know, miss anything and that the flow worked out okay. But I tend to really enjoy stories that are in the dual timeline that have that back and forth, just because I think sometimes that break from tension is, it can be fun if you play with it a little bit. So for me, it was always in the plan and I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah. And you know, the big challenge of having those dual timeline narratives is that what's happening now needs to be as compelling as what's happening in the past, because you don't want your reader loving the past more than the present or feel like they kept getting pulled back. And that's something you did so very well. Like the present was constantly compelling and the present story was moving forward at pace. And so when we went back, it didn't feel like we were being dragged back with this backstory or that it slowed down the pacing at all. So that's something for those of you who are working on dual timelines is something that you really have to consider there as well. And what you said about capturing the child's voice then as well, it's amazing that you had those journals. I think I got rid of all of my journals. So I don't have anything, I think, before high school. And those are cringeworthy enough. So yeah.
Everything's cringeworthy, really, when you read back. I mean, like what I wrote in my 20s was cringeworthy. So hey.
Yeah, but it's all part of the process. And that's the thing. You've got to write the cringeworthy stuff to learn from it, to get better. And so none of those are parts that you can hurdle over in your path to publication, because all of that stuff is what made you a better writer today. Just what you said about your Excel spreadsheets, and I want to say this for the listeners, there's an amazing software. It's called Aeon or Aeon 2. It's timeline software that you can either use for project management if you're in corporates, or you can use it for storytelling. And it keeps track of every single character, what age they are when certain things happen, the dates at which certain things happen, and you can put all kinds of information in there and color code it, which is a bit easier than Excel. And the nice thing about that is when you change a character's age for whatever reason, maybe it didn't work to have them this particular age, if you change it in the software, it changes everything else for you. So you don't have to keep track of how old each person is when. So if you're writing story like that, Amanda, look out for that software. I've found it incredibly useful.
Yeah.
In terms of your career going forward, are you working on your next book? Is it something similar? Tell us about that.
Sure. So I don't know how much I can actually talk about book two, but I can say that it also it takes place in Sri Lanka completely. And but it's a different part of Sri Lanka, because you know, whereas the girls grew up in sort of this orphanage, this focuses more on Colombo high society, and it centers around a big Sri Lankan wedding. It is a suspense, and again, it has these very nuanced, complex female narratives that I love writing.
Yeah, so it seems like you found your niche as a writer in terms of the kinds of stories you want to tell. And it's also hugely encouraging that you are in Sri Lanka, because, you know, we often get questions from our listeners who say, oh, well, I'm based in South Africa, or I'm based in Australia, or I'm based here, or I'm based there. How can I get published by an American publisher? And look at you. When you pitched to what, an American agent, and then was sold to an American publisher, and it didn't bother them at all that that's where you were based.
Mm-hmm. It didn't at all, which was absolutely fantastic for me, because, you know, sometimes you naturally think that there will be these big obstacles and hurdles. And to be fair, with all like modern technology and things like that, I haven't really faced too much of an issue being in Sri Lanka. I've never felt that was disadvantageous to me in any way at all. And like my team have been incredibly accommodating with things like the time difference. And they're very sweet. They're very concerned about, you know, whether I'm getting enough sleep these days and things like that. But I haven't really felt it be an obstacle to me in the way that I had initially thought when I started on this journey. It was certainly something that was more of a barrier in my mind. And I try to speak to as many other Sri Lankan writers as I can, or writers from other countries, just to encourage them. Because in this day and age, with like the internet and everything that's available to us now, it's really not how it used to be in the past.
Yeah. So as a freshly minted debut author, do you have any advice for our listeners who are busy working on their first manuscript, who are busy revising, who are perhaps in the trenches in terms of submitting to agents, getting all of those rejections? What's the biggest advice that you have to share with them in their journey to publication?
I think my biggest bit of advice is that these paths and these journeys, from writing to finding an agent to getting a book deal, they're all different for everyone. And, you know, you speak to some writers, they're like, I have a regimented writing structure. I wake up in the morning, I have my cup of coffee, I write for 8 hours. There are writers like me who spend a lot of time on my thinking couch and wait for the story to come. And then when it comes very quickly and it comes hard and fast, and I have to write it all down within like a month or two, or I just lose track of it. So there are different types of writers. I have friends who have writers who have met agents in completely different ways. I know writers who've been querying for 5-6 years and then found an agent. And I've had friends who have sent out like one query letter and had that agent approach them. I've had friends who've had agents seek them out because they've read their writing on some other platform, things like that. So this path is so varied. And the worst thing you can do is to watch someone else and compare yourself against them and get disheartened as to why things aren't happening the way you envisioned. And it's something that I've had to come to terms with as well, because it's so easy as a writer to think, oh, I see this person and they're doing XYZ, and why am I not doing XYZ? Or that writer is turning out so many books and I'm a really slow writer, and why am I not producing at that same speed? And it's so different for everyone. And the worst thing you can do for your writing and for your creative process is to put this unnecessary pressure on you.
Yeah, especially with those dates, deadlines, like by the time I'm 30 or by the time I'm 40 as well. So I'm glad you've learned from that.
Yeah, certainly. It was completely unnecessary. I didn't need to do that at all. But I think we just put these unnecessary rules on ourselves and we think we're accomplishing something by it. But really all we're doing is making life that much harder for ourselves.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Amanda. It's been wonderful chatting with you. For our listeners, go out and get My Sweet Girl. It was a heck of a page turner. Twists and turns, really, really enjoyable. For those of you who are working in the thriller genre or who are working with those prickly kind of protagonists as well, definitely get the book to see how Amanda did it. And we wish you much luck with this. And we hope to have you back on the podcast with your second novel.
Oh, thank you so much, Bianca. I would absolutely love to. And it was so much fun chatting with you. Thank you.
And that's it for today's episode. If you have any questions about writing or publishing, please email me at theshitaboutwriting@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to get them answered for you. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists, while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamurray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists, while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamurray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up.
Come and join us and get your memoir groove on.